outcome should be an artwork, which is, I mean, popping up all over Europe, but actually quite recent phenomenon. Okay, that's just a, by the way, of introduction. So this talk today is no more, for me, no more than an explanation, an exploration or an investigation of, for me, unknown ground or space, the border between auditory culture and the aesthetics of everyday life. By the former, I mean the cultural utterances, so the auditory culture for me is the cultural utterances which are first of all addressed to the ear. By the latter, so the aesthetics of everyday life, I mean the aesthetics that is not limited to art, perhaps not even beauty, at least not in a traditional sense. The aesthetics of everyday life is concerned with all the aesthetic experiences that arise when one contemplates on certain objects or performing acts that are not traditionally categorized as aesthetic objects or acts. However, thus talking sounds in everyday life doesn't mean I'm primarily interested in aesthetic judgments concerning these sounds. Although in experiencing, noticing them, and reflecting on them, I also include aesthetic values. The principal point I'm interested in is how we relate sonically to the world and how that changes the ways we are thinking, constructing, experiencing, developing, and changing prevailing concepts. In that sense, I fully agree with at least also the last remarks of the lecturer Jean-Paul Thibault. In other words, auditory culture is for me a critical investigator of certain conceptualizations. That's how I want to use the idea of auditory culture. That was my introduction. Now we'll do the second section, Sounds of Rotterdam. That's my hometown. Irregular polyrhythms of heavy showers, supplemented by fierce gusts of wind, sweep the windows of my study while working on this paper. White noise, filled with the rustling of the leaves of the trees in the garden and the creaking of a window left ajar. At times, it drowns out the regular sounds of the neighborhood, the drone of the nearby highway, the thudding of pile drivers, the irregular sounds of passing cars. Sounds of my playing kids, speaking, laughing, moving things, enter the present soundscape, which is further formed by the ticking of a clock, the buzz of my PC, the tapping of my fingers on the keyboard, and every now and then, the grating sounds of my trousers touching the chair and my feet touching the floor. I scratch my chin, searching for the right words and sentences. The more I listen, the more I hear. What is this irregular banging? It must be from the boys next door playing football and using our common ball as their goal. Surrounded by sound, immersed in sounds, everyday sounds, unimportant sounds. Nevertheless, they construct, determine my daily soundscape. I'm living in or amidst these sounds. Do they influence my thinking? And if so, how? And do they determine me as a subject? In Wo sind wir, wenn wir Musik hören, the German philosopher Peter Sloterdijk sketches the position of a listening subject. And according to him, it differs fundamentally from a subject which is primarily visually oriented. The ocular subjectivity implies a not involved witnessing, a necessary distance, an external relationship. The seeing subject can be located at the edge of the world. Conversely, the ear has no opposite. It does not develop a frontal sighting of an object located at some, however small, distance. Heidegger's ideas on interesse, to be among things, resonate in Sloterdijk's analysis. Listening means being in sound, being amidst the acoustic event. It is this ontological involvement subsistent in oral experiences, the which can initiate a contact between the control of the eye, a contact with the inexhaustible richness of that which surrounds us. According to Sloterdijk, music that corresponds to this listening attitude can be called exodus music, whereas he opposes that with sedative music, which makes every effort not to hear the world, not to hear otherness. In 1997, so this essay, Rosinfield and Musiklern, is from 1993. In 1997, Sloterdijk resumes his being in sound in a book called Im selben Boot, and locates it as a fundamental being in the world in man's earliest existence. Already, he writes, in prehistoric times, people created and demarcated space by means of sounds. Rhythm, music and language tied members of prehistorical communities together to a solid group. For these nomads, belonging together equals being able to hear each other. By another, hören means to hear each other. Psychoacoustical umbilical cords connect each individual to the sonospheric continuum of the group. In Boots and Pastures, the first invisible order is established between the self and the other, between the known and unknown, between the canny and the uncanny, through group sounds and sounds of hostile environment. By talking, singing, clapping, and drumming, the group secures its own acoustic continuum. In Spheres, his trilogy from the beginning of the third millennium, Sloterdijk translates this demarcation of space by sound to present day. Here, he presents a housing unit as an autonomous atmospheric reality. Dwelling is a measure of defense with which a domain of well-being can be protected from intruders and others causing discomfort. The house as a defense mechanism or psychosocial immune system, as he calls it. For that, the house has to be an oral microsphere or phonotope, in which the occupant realizes a technique of isolation through a relative freedom of listening as he can construct his own soundscape. Sloterdijk's analysis resonates in the most recent book by Brandon LaBelle called Acoustic Territories. According to LaBelle, the home can be appreciated as a counterbalance to the dynamics of exposure to the challenges of city life. The home operates as a space of physical safety, an image of comfort. Such perspective carries within it a sense for auditory clarity, where order is equated with quietness and audible regulation. To come home is to seek refuge from the uncontrollable flows of noise of the exterior. In the weave of self and sound, the home might be said to function as an elaborated sonorous envelope, talking about envelopes, keeping safe an imaginary or primary oral warmth. According to Michael Boole, the car can also be considered a phonotope or sonorous envelope. In the essay, The Soundscapes of the Car, Boole describes the cultural meaning of the car in terms of individualism, freedom, autonomy, and control. The car is a private space of habitation, a home from home. Oral privacy is guaranteed by exercising sounds of the environment by car radio or CD player. The urban world of instability is kept outside. Privatized listening as a barrier between the subject and the exterior world. However, how realistic is this almost idyllic picture? Sloterdijk himself states that a house is at once a perfectly isolated egosphere and well accessible knot in a network of multiple online communities. In other words, the alleged autonomous phonotope of a housing unit is always already permeated by external impulses, by external sounds. And I'm not talking here so much about musical sounds coming from a radio or TV unit. I'm aiming more at the ecology of hydraulic gurgles, industrial rumbles, the seismology of traffic, the synthetic sounds of alarms, ringtones, etc., and the existence of human noises, audible because of what Sloterdijk calls the principle of co-isolation. In the sonic composition of the city, Jean-Paul Thibault shows how technical devices such as Walkman or car radio, deconstruct the sharp distinction between private places and public places. These devices function not only as a protection against city noise, so you're not only cut off from the urban environment, they also filter sounds that signify the spaces the car driver, the pedestrian, or the cyclist with an iPod in his head traverses. Whereas Walkmans and iPods, etc., offer possibilities of private listening in a public space, which Thibault calls the process of territorialization, he also thinks the private realm is associated with openness towards the surroundings. These sonic doors put a subject on a threshold between in and outside. Now, the conclusion I would like to draw from this is that the oral warmth of the sonorous envelope is always threatened or supplemented, at least, by external sounds. In other words, I would call that the deconstruction of the autonomous phonotope. Neighbor taking a shower creates an intrusion onto one's space, although he simultaneously is giving way to new forms of connectivity. This brings me to the reflection on, that's the final part, my talk on the listening subject. More than the decomposition of an urban soundscape or oral microspheres of the home, I'm interested in what these comments by Sloterdijk and Thibault on the alleged subjective control of the sonic environment can mean for a subject as such. Where are we when we listen to music? According to Peter Sloterdijk, the location remains vague. It is only certain that while listening to music, one can never be completely in the world. To listen to music means either to move towards the world or to flee from it, either to be on the way there or on the way back. In both cases, however, listening suggests displacement and movement. I would like to follow this beginning of the deconstruction of the subject through the ideas of Jean-Luc Nancy, which he presented in his book Listening, à l'écoute. In the act of listening, Jean-Luc Nancy discerns two vibrating bodies, the sound source and the body of the listener. Both bodies vibrate and resonate, that is, they produce movements that simultaneously take them back to themselves and outside of themselves. So it is the re in resonating that is important. Vibrating is always already re-vibrating, going back and forth, emitting and returning, extension and penetration. Vibration is a motion of infinite transmission and returning, a dynamics of coming and going, and therefore essentially mobile. Okay, and when this is characteristic of both a sound emitter and sound receiver, to listen means to penetrate as well as to be penetrated, to be connected to the outside as well as to the inside, to be passive in receiving as well as active in giving back, to be the vibrating body, as well as not to be a proper and stable self, fully present to itself. thinking, the vibrating body, the listening body, thus leads to a destabilization of the self as an autonomous subject. The well-definable unity conscious to itself is criticized by rethinking what it means to listen. The idea of a stable self is replaced by the thought that the subject is always already formed in and through interactions, which implies that it is formed through difference. A temporary self only comes into existence through others. These processes, these social processes of identity formation, lead to a radically decentered self, decentered by the idea of the intertwining of self and other, a differential interplay, an interplay of identity and difference. The more I listen, the more I hear. I am surrounded by sound, immersed in sounds, everyday sounds, unimportant sounds. Nevertheless, they construct, determine my daily soundscape. I am living in or amidst these sounds. But who is this I? Where is this I? What is this I? Like I said in the beginning, auditory culture makes it possible for us to rethink prevailing concepts. Concepts like I, subject, and self. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have time for questions. So please, Eric.
Yes, thank you. Taking the Nazi example, or imagining, isn't it then moving towards much more of a kinesthetic dimension than an oral one? That it's actually as much the skin experiencing sound and being penetrated by sound as ear, so to speak.
Yeah, when I wrote this beginning sentence, that auditory culture for me is something that's primarily directed to the ear, I thought I feel kind of uncomfortable with that, because I think that listening or let's say experiencing sound is not necessarily only going through the ears, but is especially with one of my favorite musics is experimental electronic music. Whereas I have constantly this experience that this is not going through my ears, even if I'm listening to it by headphones, but it's getting in my skin, it's getting subdermal, so in that sense, I absolutely agree with you that it's not only an oral experience, but still dealing with it. It is a kind of sonic experience, which not only goes through the ear. Mm. Yeah.
Sorry? What's your name?
Oh, I'm Wilson Shaw, Newcastle from England. You kind of mentioned at the beginning something that has cropped up like a few times. People keep talking about sound in relation to the self in terms of immanence, essentially, or this kind of, it was mentioned earlier on today as well, and has kind of, it sort of keeps cropping up. But I was kind of interested in, you were talking as well, obviously, a lot about the nature of like personal space and sound and things, stuff that requires a certain distinction. I wonder if there's a sort of a tendency at the moment to downplay the critical aspect of listening, where the sort of tuned, honed ear can make distinct and distance, bodies as much as the eye, insofar as it's a trained ear, essentially. That it's sort of that there's a slight kind of simplicity in saying that sound makes you kind of fully connected, fully immanent, whereas other things don't. I wonder whether that's just purely because of a certain lack of awareness, and also that the idea of self essentially acquires a certain alterity and a certain necessary distinction from things. So whether self is necessarily the right word for talking in terms of the immanence of sound, and whether there needs to be a sort of slightly more complicated notion of the individual. perhaps, so I suppose that's 2 points.
Yeah, well, I didn't have the intention to create a clear opposition between an oral relation to the world and a visual relation to the world. It is more, and again, I sympathize with what Jean-Paul Thibault said in his lecture or in the questionnaire afterwards, that maybe by emphasizing the solid relation, you can rephrase certain questions, where you can rethink certain concepts or conceptualizations with which we usually, whatever that word means, approach our relation to the world. And why I started with Sloterdijk and Michael Moore and also Brandon Labelle is because they seemed, at least from the paragraphs or from the text that I selected, seemed somehow to secure the self in their oral relation to the world by secluding you from what is going on in the world. And that idea I was trying to contest, to challenge in my paper. So in the sense that it's more complicated, or that might be true perhaps, but that's only half the story. So of course the whole idea of a stable subject, etc., is already criticized in philosophy, but now it gets, I think, a new ground also through Sonic studies. So that was my intention.
Thank you. Thomas from Aarhus University. This is just a basic question in line with what Eric was asking you before, maybe the topic of vibration. Is this something that auditory cultures are dealing more with at the moment? Is this some kind of new theme that has emerged within the latest couple of years? I'm also thinking of Steve Goodman's recent book on sonic warfare, which deals quite a lot with that phenomenon. So that would be my question now that you
well,
it up.
it's quite simple that I don't have a total overview of everything on sonic culture or whatever. It is more that my interest goes in that direction. Also related to the question that was posed by the sonic branding, which goes also in not directly or not almost directly to the ear, but it's somehow on a very subconscious level that thing, and that goes, among other things, through vibrations. So I think this whole topic is actually perhaps becoming prominent through the interest for auditory culture. But I really don't know if that is specifically hot at this moment. It's just the author that I'm interested in who are dealing with that.
Nossi, sure.
And Goodman, among others.
Thank you. Sorry. My question is thinking about the model of the phonotope and thinking about what you mentioned about control and to what extent do we control the sources of sound that are available to us in our home or in our car. This seems to point, if you don't think about it too little, this seems to point to almost like a positioning yourself as a listener. But I'm thinking about their experience when you're driving with someone and there's one of the people kind of takes charge of the car radio. And I'm thinking about this idea of how controlling the sound sources in a certain environment is a way of expressing yourself, even if at the same time you're kind of blocking out others from enjoying your performance. So my question had to do with that, about how you encompass that nuance of how this control also is performing, not just listening.
It definitely so. And I think that's also what I said in relation to when I brought up this concept of phonotope through Sloterdijk, because he's not only addressing the listening subject, but also you are in control when you are actually choosing the CD and or whatever it is that how do you want to create your phonotope? So in that sense, it is not only passive, if you can call a listening subject passive, which I would deny, but it is an active contribution to shape your world orally. So in that sense, it's not only dealing with a listening subject. Now, your example of when somebody else is in the car and he or she picks a radio station that he or she wants to listen to. I think, of course, there's already more of interaction going on, human interaction in a certain way. But I think that in this specific example, it never goes without negotiation. So it will be then decided in that, I mean, it's still a phonotope. In a sense, it's still secluding. I mean, it's also this whatever the choice is and how it will be negotiated. It's still, why are you doing that? Partly because you want to create a new ambience, a new atmosphere, which is somehow, which at least differs from the sonic environment that you're in at that moment. And you have. So whether you're two or ten or one, you are in control. You can control, to a certain extent, that environment. The only thing that I'm interested in, and that's why I'm referring to Thibault, is because you are, most of the time, you're still, I mean, it's more complicated than that. So you're not totally excluding the sounds that are there, but it's kind of, you are there, and you are. Same time we are outside, we are also in this other world, and maybe in an imaginary world, hearing the sounds that are outside of your car or outside of the phonotope you're in, but not only an imaginary level, because you also get oral information that is not on the CD or radio set that you're listening to at the moment. So it is in that sense more complicated than what I think Michael Boole is presenting.
Time is up. You have time for one final remark, if you want, or we could just say.
I've said everything else.
Okay. Thank you very much.